begin this morning, can you all hear me off the back there? Am I large enough? Good. I want to begin on the 19th of June, 1250, when the great and the good of the Scottish kingdom assembled in Dunfermline Abbey. The number included the king, Alexander III, his mother, Mary Cressy, and many bishops and abbots and earls and barons. And pretty much the entire Scottish political establishment had come to witness the translation of the bones of and the earthly remains of Margaret, the late 11th century queen, great-great-great-grandmother of Alexander III. And when Margaret's body was exhumed, the air was suddenly filled with such an intense and sweet-smelling fragrance that, said, men thought that the entire sanctuary had been sprinkled with the fragrance of spices and the scent of flowers and fruits. And amidst musical accompaniment and singing, Margaret's body was then carried to its new resting place. But as the cortege passed the burial plot of her husband Malcolm III, the pallbearers found themselves paralysed and unable to move Margaret's body any further. After reflect, they eventually heard a divinely inspired voice, which loudly proclaimed that it was perhaps not God's will that the bones of the Holy Queen should be translated before her husband's tomb had been honoured in the same way. Martin's bones were then raised, releasing the invisible impediment to Margaret's progression, and King and Queen were then duly reinterred in elegantly new tombs, in the design of new tombs. Now there are two very clear reminders in that pageant that the audience was witnessing sanctity. Sweet fragrances, well, that was stock in trade for the exhumation of sacred bodies in the grave. And miracles, such as the invisibility of the cortege to progress beyond Malcolm's body, were exactly what medieval people expected of their saints. Now Margaret's new saintly status and the theatrical events which were enacted in the Dunfermline in 1250, this is not an improvised accident that takes place. Sanctity did not just happen. It wasn't spontaneous. Or at least it wasn't meant to be spontaneous anymore by the 13th century. Instead, the process of saint-making had become a protracted exercise. Popes were centralising the process of canonisation, they were devising formal and lengthy processes of verifying saints. Many saints now waited in a long queue for canonisation. The first surviving letters of postulation in favour of St Thomas Canton for Hereford dated from 1290. A commission of inquiry for his deed wasn't appointed until 1306, and it was only in 30 years after the process began. Now we don't know in the case of Margaret how much time her case took, because the papers relating to her canonisation have long since perished. We do know that Pope Innocent IV appointed a commission of inquiry into her case in July of 1245. But in the Canterbury case, it was all typical. The initial process of lobbying was much, much earlier, maybe in the early 1240s, probably, I think, between the 1280s and 1240s, but possibly even as early as 1240. Nevertheless, despite this long wait for papal approval, we know, from the collection of we know that Margaret Margaret, in other words, didn't have a saint long before she was officially canonized. Her sanctity was in origin, in other words, it was old style practice, sanctity by popular acclamation. And the investigation lost her focus in the form, merely sought to add a new veneer to her already flourishing saintly reputation. So why, you might wonder, why bother with seeking papal approval when everybody already recognised her? Well, somebody could have bothered. And I think one of our shambles was not that 8-year-old boy who was at the ceremony to witness her relics being translated in 1250, but rather his father. His father, King Alexander II, whose reign had begun in 1250. Now, although the precise nature of that king's intervention on behalf of Margaret remains unknown, his support was explicitly referred to by Scotland's report. And the king's promotion of Margaret's canonisation is in part a thing to be explained, obviously, by his relationship to the late queen. She was his great-great-grandmother. Her canonisation would provide the royal family with its own in-house thing. Moreover, the queen and her husband were often regarded as the founders of the royal dynasty. Sometimes Margaret was even credited for that role without any acknowledgement of her husband. She was also regarded as the protector of the kingdom. In 1263, she had reportedly appeared in a vision to Sir John Weems, and in this dream, she was accompanied by four knights. Not recognizing the woman, Sir John asks, as you can see there, "I beg you, lady, to tell me who you are and who are these armed knights." And the queen replied, "I am Margaret, Queen of Scots. This knight I am leading by the hand was my husband, King Malcolm by name. The three following are my three sons, kings who lie with me in this church." "Where are you going, lady?" said the knight. "I am hurrying with them to Lark," said the Holy Queen, "to bring victory over the tyrant who is attempting to subject my kingdom to his power. For I have accepted this kingdom from God, and it is entrusted to me and my heirs forever." Well, the next day, Sir John heads to Margaret Shine in Dunfermline, and news arrives that the so-called tyrant, the Norwegian king, Harald IV, had been defeated at the Battle of Large by a combination of storms and swords. Well, this is perhaps one of Margaret's better-known miracles, but we may presume that it was a quest for similar divine support that had prompted Alexander II's father, William the Lion, to visit Dunfermline in 1199, though on that occasion we're told the Queen warned William not to invade England, and he duly disbanded his army. A more encouraging response was perhaps acquired by Alexander II when he visited Dunfermline immediately before what actually turned out to be a rather ill-fated campaign for him in the Western Isles. So we might explain the role support of Margaret's canonisation, both in terms of family loyalty and in terms of the divine protection, which we thought she extended to the military endeavours of her independence. But I think there's another context too in which we have to set the royal support for Margaret's canonisation. The efforts to have Margaret canonised coincided with, or very probably related to, a larger diplomatic initiative which the king was mounting, and which was designed in essence to exalt, to bolster his own royal authority. Aside from the family of Margaret, the aim of this initiative was to win papal approval for the crowning and for the anointing of Scottish kings. The crown, the prism with which other kings were anointed, these are amongst the most striking symbols of royal power in the Middle East. And they were seen as evidence that just as Margaret had declared to Sir John Weems that kings accepted their kingdom from God, well, kings derived their power from God, and those who could not display their godly associations increasingly felt their royal power to be defective. But whereas the Norwegian king had successfully pleaded for the right to a crown and to be anointed in 1247, Alexander's efforts failed. His request to the papacy rejected in 1221, rejected again in 1237, rejected yet again, maybe a little less pointedly, in 1261. Alexander's ambitions were consistently being blocked by English opposition, as the king must surely have anticipated. That, however, was precisely why Margaret's canonisation was so important. Margaret, let us remember, Margaret was already king. And she no more needed papal canonisation than is the Olaf of Norway or St. Eric of the Long Sweden, or Swan Sweden, who had come to punish without any need. And he was elsewhere, perhaps in the air, organization was not for Scott. Bishops were directly answerable to the Pope, and certainly in the latter stages of the process, we know that many of them, particularly the Bishop of St Andrews, David Burnham, were very important in winning the canonization. If we're to date the initiation of the process to have Margaret canonized, then Burnham's appointment as bishop was probably very significant. His predecessor, William Malvoisin, who died in 1238, he went down and confirmed on tradition as a man hostile to the abbey, a man who diddled amongst house of ecclesiastical revenue. And he, moreover, allegedly at least, never forgave the monks for having served up rather stingy supplies of alcohol. Burnham aside, other bishops were also involved in the process of inquiring for Margaret's merit. But notwithstanding royal support and episcopal support, Margaret's campaign, I think, relied on a third source of support as well. St Fermin's abbot had to back the plan too. And from 1240, it possesses a highly able, extremely pushy, and intensely political abbot in Robert Kinney, who does just that back. But why, we might wonder, why did the abbot seek to promote a cult which was already vibrant? An initial assumption, I suppose, might be that the abbey stood to gain financially from the increase in pilgrims, which canonisation, it might be expected. And indeed, there was money to be made from pilgrims, pilgrims who routinely left offerings to their favourite saints. Still, I don't think we should exaggerate the extent for potential profit here. Pilgrimage comes with costs. We know that the abbey mounted a significant and costly building program in the early 13th century, not least to relocate Margaret's shrine. We may presume too that internal decoration had to be paid for. Now, there isn't, of course, much left of the internal decoration in the abbey nowadays, but we might expect that Margaret's new shrine would have had decorations like this. This is from the Shrine of St. Dorothy in Ystad in southern Sweden. But there would be a highly decorative environment, almost certainly, and that too would have cost money. Abbeys were also burdened with the responsibility to provide food and shelter for pilgrims. Some of that indeed long-term commitment. We're told that the abbot lodged one pilgrim, I quote, for many years in his own chamber. And even the greatest shrines in Christendom found it difficult to make ends meet. The monks of Our Lady of Rocamadour in France were forced to pawn their tapestries and their curtains at the cost of hosting pilgrimages. Mushrooms. Unfortunately, we don't know anything for certain about the income from the infernal pilgrims or the expenses made on their behalf, but if it was profit that Abbot Robert was after, then the chances are the balance sheet was rather mixed. But Robert might have been after something rather different. Abbot Robert's abbey, I think, was in many ways on skid row by the person. Its monks were of the Benedictine variety, but even when Margaret had first brought Godwin and his two fellow Benedictines from Canterbury to Dunfermline, this is not the most vibrant type of monasticism on the market. By the 12th and 13th centuries, the mantle of fashionable monasticism has passed on to other orders, with assertion Cyrenaican. And by the 13th century, old-style Benedictine monasticism is facing yet another challenge from the new mendicant orders of friars, led by the Dominicans and Franciscans, whose mission is focused on ministering to the urban poor. Now, competition between all these orders, it matters because it has an impact both on patronage, on what the religious in society might expect to receive from the laity in return prayers, and it has an impact on status too. So, while the government was safe in its world history, by the following connections were beginning to fade. neither William the Lion nor Alexander the Second, frequently. Two of Alexander the Second's surviving acts are dated in Dunfermline. Dunfermline is not a significant centre of government, and even Dunfermline's monopoly on the royal dead was being broken. William the Lion had died in Stirling, and although Dunfermline could not have been a more convenient location for his burial, the king's body is whisked past Dunfermline and buried instead at the new Turinensian Abbey of Arbroath, in 1178. And similarly, avoiding Dunfermline completely, the body of his son, Alexander II, is buried in the Cistercian Abbey of Melrose. So, Dunfermline is losing its special royal prominence. Arbroath, in particular, is hogging ever more of the royal patronage. And even Dunfermline's primary state is being overshadowed. Arbroath's prestige derived not just from its royal lineage, but also from its patron, St. Thomas Becket. St. Thomas Becket, the most fashionable saint of his day, whose cult resonated across every corner of Christendom. Canterbury, where the cult of course focused, Canterbury becomes a major focus of Scottish pilgrimage as well. And then Dunfermline just seems a little bit tired by comparison in its saint of it wasn't quite a one saint town, Dunfermline, but we do know that Dunfermline's hagiographic repertoire is a little bit constricted. Older Celtic saints, alluded to in names like Pitbochley, Limmer, these appear to have been eradicated very soon after Margaret's arrival. And even the Abbey's dedication to the Holy Trinity did nothing to promote alternative faith or add faith to the firm of the saintly men. Now, canonization wasn't going to change that, of course, but canonization would make Dunfermline unique in Scotland. It would make Margaret one of only the Scottish saints who was canonized by the papacy between 1200 and 1334. Canonization and a host of other privileges, which this very assertive and pushy abbot and Robert Wyatt, this reinvigorates Dunfermline's status quite substantially. So we have Margaret canonized, but what impact, one might wonder, what impact does her sanctity have for the people of Dunfermline? Not every community welcomes pilgrimage traffic. The inhabitants of Vainbury and Burgundy murdered their local abbot in 1106 because he had burdened townsmen to accommodate them. Now, Dunfermline was probably more typical in coping or seeking to cope with those who flocked to her shrine in the 12th and 13th century. In the compilation of Margaret's miracles, we hear frequently of great crowds, especially on Saturday night, with many pilgrims staying in the church for 2-3 nights. Officials were required in the church to police the movement of these great crowds who were there. They were noisy too. They walked around the shrine, they touched it, they kissed the shrine, they slept overnight in the church. Now that silence was very common in other shrines too, as depicted in these nice illustrations from St. Gallen in Switzerland. But this is very much the picture one might have expected in the Dunfermline too. Of course, we might question the veracity of sources which are designed to promote Margaret's standing. But I think other factors also point to pilgrimage traffic being quite substantial. The very architecture of the abbey, the translation of Margaret's body and relics, firstly in 1180, then again in 1250, that may very well have been inspired by the need to deal with a large number of visitors by routing the pilgrims away from other busy areas in the church. And it's possible too, at least if I understand the archaeological developments, and I'm glad Pat Simpson's there, so she can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but if I understand the archaeological evidence correctly, then the development of the Maygate and the intrusion of an entry through the abbey walls to the north may well have coincided with the relocation. well have been related to Tractatus. Now, what attracted such numbers to Dunfermline was, of course, the hope for divine intercession, the hope that Saint Margaret would use her influence on God to effect a miracle. Now, the miracle collection of Margaret that makes that quite explicit. A great crowd of sick people at stake hurried to be present at the important vigils in the hope of recovering their health. Now, Margaret's clientele was not especially unusual for a saint, but it was really a roll call, desperate. Several visitors were carried on litters. And the types of miracles which she allegedly performed, well, they were fairly common for a medieval saint. Most of them, as you can see from that table, most of them in favour of sick men. Now, there is, of course, a question as to the reliability of the miracle collection. It follows a fairly standard trope, written by clerics who were intent on promoting Margaret's cult. And, of course, modern 21st century minds are highly sceptical of miracles. But if we are to take anything of the miracle collection, I think we have to suspend our 21st century judgments and interpretations and try to understand the world as it seems to medieval people. It matters not, by that standard, whether these miracles were real or not. What matters is whether people believe them to be real and why they believe them to be real. Now, most, as the crowd of the sick testify, most did, I think, hope for believing miraculous cures. Their belief was, of course, greatly informed by Christian teaching, but also by completely different conceptions, completely different explanations of time, of medicine, of the difference between the living and the dead that we would know. The miracle collection is then testimony to medieval faith, and yet it also reveals religious doubt. Why, we might wonder, why did a Dunfermline woman afflicted by blindness, why did it take her two years, to wander just down the road to St. Margaret to seek help? More explicitly still, Margaret intervened to persuade a monk, racked by religious doubt, to retain his monastic. So we have reasonable indications that Margaret's sanctity attracted a substantial number of pilgrims in the 12th and 13th century. And the miracle collection suggests that most of these people were local, or elsewhere in Scotland, with only a very few from further afield, and all of them from England. This is a regional cult, and it seems unlikely that it developed into anything more significant in later centuries. We have for later centuries, but only glimpses of later. In the 15th century, Blancani writes of pilgrims coming to Dunfermline, especially women. They were perhaps seeking Margaret's reassurance while pregnant. And we know too that pregnant 15th century queens sought the comfort of wearing a shirt, which had allegedly once belonged to St. Margaret. And yet I wonder here if we have something of a case of mistaken saintly identity. None of Margaret's recorded miracles relate to childbirth, but are actually much more famous namesakes than Margaret of Antioch. She was renowned for a particular interest in such issues, and immediately before her martyrdom, she had allegedly prayed that no physically impaired child be born to those who venerate. What's more, the compiler of our Margaret's miracles admits this confusion, I think, between the two Margarets, to dismiss the problem of confusion on the somewhat, I think, unconvincing grounds, well, that one thing is Margaret's identity, though, I think, was not that sharply drawn, we have to say, even amongst those who were drawn to her shrine, though this confusion perhaps does help to maintain the discernment. Now, of course, we have to be careful about drawing conclusions from silence, but there are other hints too that Margaret's cult did not develop significantly after its 13th century AD. more important shrine. Pilgrims purchased souvenirs, souvenir badges, which it was believed contained the same miraculous powers that the shrine possesses. But so far as I'm aware, no such badges have been found within Cranwell. And the miracle collection suggests that with no badges, pilgrims instead had to make do with the dust that they collected from the shrine, which they would collect, and smear on teeth to cure toothache, or mix with water to cure other ailments. It's difficult, too, to detect much sign of a vibrant service sector in the town, catering for an influx of visitors. So that might be, of course, because the Abbey undercut local entrepreneurialism by providing free board and lodging. Still, if the crowds had been large, you might have expected to find some trace of pilgrimage in the 15th century town record, but there aren't any. Perhaps, though I think the most significant sign of stagnation, is what seems to be an attempt to reinvigorate the cult in the later 15th century. During James III's reign, 1460-1468, the miracle collection is copied. And it's towards the end of James's reign that Pope Innocent VIII inaugurates an inquiry concerning the life, character, and miracles of Margaret, sometimes Queen of Scots. Now that has often been interpreted as an attempt to have James' wife, Margaret of Denmark, canonized. But with no indication of any cult surrounding her, and it seems that just as likely that this is an attempt to revive the old Queen's cult, by indeed a not uncommon method. We shouldn't, however, be surprised if numbers have stagnant or even fallen at Margaret's shrine. And that was because, wasn't because everybody had gone off to prepare for the Reformation. It's quite normal for shrines to wax and wane in their popularity, and it all depends on the use of miracles. Now, we don't know whether Margaret's still performing miracles in the 14th 15th century, but even if she wasn't, let me conclude by just reminding you about the mentality of the late medieval population. It had probably changed little from the early centuries. Belief in God was almost certainly universal, even if his rules might occasionally be infringed. Even a little bit of blasphemy, indeed, invited trouble. In the early 15th century, during a period of dearth, a few girls from Dunfermline wandered down to Lime Kiln in search of food and shelter. And their walk was interrupted by a crash of thunder and a flash of light. And most of the girls immediately crossed themselves, but one mocked her friends and shouted, "Christ's cross on my back, fellow." And no sooner had she blasphemed than she was, of course, thrown to the ground by the lightning and burnt to cinder, stain for her genitals, and backside, which remains visible.